The book of Genesis and chapter 49. And we commence at verse 1 of Genesis 49. And Jacob called unto his sons and said, Gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. Gather yourselves together and hear, ye sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, thou shalt not accept, because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, then defiledst thou it. He went up to my couch. Simeon and Levi are better, instruments of cruelty, are in their habitations. O my soul, come not thou into their secret, unto their assembly mine honour. Be not thou united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall, or they crippled the ox. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. And then we have Judah, we'll reserve it for tomorrow night. Verse 13, Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for an haven of ships, and his border shall be unto, or his border shall be toward Zidon. Issachar is a strong ass, couching down between two burdens, and he saw that rest was good, and the land that it was pleasant, and he bowed his shoulder to bear, and became a servant unto tribute. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an otter in the path that biteth the horse heels, so that his rider shall fall backward. I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. And then we have God in verse 19, Asher, Naphtali, and Joseph in verse 22, Benjamin in verse 27, verse 28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is it that their father spake unto them and blessed them. Every one according to his blessing, he blessed them. Now, perhaps I should read verse 33 tonight just to conclude the chapter. And when Jacob had made an end of commanding his sons, he gathered up his feet into the bed and yielded up the ghost and was gathered unto his people. And that's our reading. And we trust with the Lord's gracious blessing upon his word. Over the centuries, people have had a fascination with the last words of great men. They have often been recorded, and they have frequently been repeated. Some of the things that have been recorded and repeated were perhaps not so significant. But in the Bible, we have quite a number of interesting last words. We could turn to the book of Joshua, and we think about the last words of that great soldier. We could turn to, for example, the second book of Samuel, chapter 23, and we could think of the last words of David the sovereign. We could go into the New Testament, and we could think of the last words of the Apostle Paul, the servant and the preacher, in 2 Timothy, those precious chapters of that book. How many times from this very desk, people have been reminded, both in ministry meetings and in gospel meetings, of the last words of the Savior, exceedingly precious. And here, we are considering tonight, specifically, the last words of the sojourner. The pilgrim Jacob has reached the end of his earthly course. We have read at the end here that he gathers up his feet into his bed, he's gathered to his people, and be the record of Jacob's final statements. When one of the founders of communism was dying, Karl Marx, the lady who was his housekeeper, she knew about his illness and that the time was short, and she came in to ask him if he had anything that in particular he wanted to say that would be recorded for posterity. The last words of Karl Marx. She had pencil and paper ready to take a note of what he was saying. He said, Get out! Woman, he said, Get out! He said, last words are only for fools that haven't said enough. Well, certainly he had said enough. In his life, he had said enough of foolish things. And with his ideologies, he had brainwashed millions. And it has very cost them their soul, as well as their lives. But there are people, and they're not fools, and they say things at the end of their day that bespeaks ripened experience with God, and bespeaks matured spiritual wisdom. And certainly that was the case with this man, Jacob. As you know, we've been considering in the previous two nights, we have thought about Jacob's words to his grandson, to the second generation. And now, of course, tonight, we're thinking about Jacob's words to his son, to the next generation, passing on the vision, so that the work that Jacob had taken and the vision that he had taken from his father and his grandfather, there were two generations behind him to whom he was greatly indebted. There were two generations following him, and Jacob wanted to make sure that he would pay his debt to them. You know, those who are older, I've mentioned this on previous dates, and I don't want to be repeating it, but I just want to say it again. The older brethren and sisters amongst us, whom we respect, and we appreciate your spiritual steadiness and your good example, you have a debt to the next generation. And there's a spiritual legacy that you are responsible to pass on. And there's a torch of testimony, and there's a baton of testimony that has to be handed on. And I think in these two chapters of Genesis, we certainly find some indications of how that can be done. Now, as far as the chapter is concerned, I'll not make many remarks about it in general. I'll make some more of those tomorrow night, God willing. But you can see that this gathering, it was quite a solemn gathering. Actually, twice over here in the opening verses, in verse number 1 it tells us, Jacob called his sons and said, gather yourselves together. And then in verse 2 it's repeated, gather yourselves together. So that Jacob wanted his sons all to be assembled. It wasn't a matter that he sent word and said, tell Isaac to call in with me someday. I've something I'd like to say to him. And tell Reuben to call someday when he's passing. And tell Dan, I would like a word in his ear some afternoon. He says, I want them all to come. It must have been quite a job. Because I presume that these men were located as shepherds in one of the most spacious and fertile parts of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen, and they were shepherds, they would have been spread out across the land of Goshen. So they get these 12 boys all gathered up, including Joseph, the whole 12 of them, to bring them into the bedchamber where the old man was dying. Just his last day on earth. He said, now, I want them all to be there. He said, this is not going to be a private meeting. This will become more serious just in a few minutes. He said, what I say to Reuben, he said, I want the other 11 to hear. And what I say to Dan, he said, I want the others to hear. He said, it's not just to put a word into each one. He said, assemble them together. And so they all gathered. They just made it in time. Because when he finished with the last one, he said, goodbye, gentlemen. And he died that day. Not only was there a solemn assembly, I think as those bearded shepherds, some of them were anything but youngsters. Some of them in their 70s and 80s. At least their 70s. Quite a number of them in their 60s. Joseph himself in his 50s. As they stood around the bottom of the old man's bed, I think there was a strange silence in the room as he went across one by one. Never missed a beat. Never slipped a syllable. Never repeated himself needlessly. He had something to say to, and something to say about every single one of them. And he not only convened the assembly, but when he got them there, he called for their attention. He says, "Hearken." And then he repeated it. He said, "Hear." He said, "I want you to listen." There was nobody sleeping in that meeting. It's a phenomenon that has happened from time to time since then, even to this present meeting. Nobody says, "Now listen." He said, "You'll not have to hear me ever again." And he said, "I have some final things that I want to say." And I think that you'll agree with me that it would have been absolutely riveting upon the old man as he sat up in his bed and as he stood. In his address, he called them sons of Jacob. He said, "Hearken unto me, ye sons of Jacob, and hear me, ye. Hear Israel, your father." So they're sons of Jacob and they're sons of Israel. And mind you, as we go on, we'll discover there was a fair bit of Jacob in them. And they showed some of the crookedness that had marked the early days of their father. He said, "I want to speak about the last day." You know, that's an amazing, that's the first time that this expression occurs in the Bible. You get it over a dozen times later on. But the first man to use it, he said, "I want to tell you men a message of destiny that will reach away out into the future." And he said, in light of the destiny that I'm going to tell you about, he said, "I want you to live the rest of your days in light of that destiny." You see, we have sometimes prophetic meetings, and there's nothing wrong with prophetic meetings. They excite a great deal of interest, and people love them. And prophecy has excited a good deal of controversy and a good deal of curiosity over the years. But just let me remind you that if God has told us in his Bible about things that are yet to come, he doesn't tell us those things to satisfy curiosity nor to generate controversy. He tells us what's coming in order that it may change our lives here and now in the present. So that prophecy is intended to be practical. We do that in our gospel preaching. We tell the sinner about what's coming and what the Bible says about hell. And if the sinner listens to that, it changes his whole outlook upon life. And then we bring the Christians together. We tell the Christians what the Bible says to us about heaven. And if we really listen to that, it's likewise expected to make as big a change upon our lives. So that here's a man telling men about the future so that it might impact them in the present. Now he goes through the sons. I'm not going to look tonight at all the different pronouncements that he made. Indeed, when you read some of these pronouncements, you wonder, are the blessings at all? Because there's very little blessing in some of them, at least at first glance. And what I want to do tonight is, more or less, and this is not a rigid category, but I want to look at the six negative pronouncements. And then tomorrow night, in the will of the Lord, we'll take a look at the six positive pronouncements. As I said already, it was very public. They all heard it. It was also very personal. It was prophetic. It was very profitable. They were very practical things that they said, and very pertinent things. And I hope the Lord will help us just to see one or two of them. Now the first man, the address, of course, was Reuben. Reuben. He makes quite a statement about Reuben. In fact, as he opens his statement about Reuben, he makes five statements about Reuben's status. If you look at verse 3, if you have your Bible open, if not, I read it, you can listen. "Reuben, thou art my firstborn." Number one, "my might." Number two, "the beginning of my strength." Number three, The excellency of dignity, number four. The excellency of power, number five. Five great statements about Reuben's status. Many of you know, in fact we know it from the earlier part of the book of Genesis, that the name Reuben, it simply means behold a son, the firstborn. When Reuben was born, there was the great excitement at the birth of a male child. And the exclamation was given, God has carried on the line. Do you see the seed? Behold a son. And now Jacob said, he said, Reuben, you were my pride and joy. He said, you were the leader of the family line. He said, you were the commencement of the whole tribe, of the whole 12. The excellency of dignity, the excellency of power, my firstborn, my might. And I could nearly see Reuben. Reuben standing up now and says, boys, I'm the one. You hear what he says about me? Nearly take a glance around just at the other boys to see how they're getting all this. Do you hear the five great things that Father has said about me? I'm the leader of you all. He said that I'm the excellency of his strength, and I'm the excellency of his power. He said, you fellas make the good, but he said, I'm excellent. And there. After making those five positive statements, just like a sledgehammer blow, thou shalt not excel. But you just said, Father, you have just said that I was the excellency of your dignity and the excellency of your power. What do you mean that I not excel? Have I lost my distinctions, Father? Exactly. Exactly, Reuben. The place of leadership, Reuben, that you did have and that you should have had and that should have continued. He said, I want to tell you, when the tribes go into the land, Reuben, you're not going to accept. He said, Reuben, I want to say solemnly that instead of a place of leadership, unfortunately, Reuben, you're going to have an experience of loss. He said the advantages and the privileges that you were born with as the firstborn son, he said, they have been jeopardized and you will never reach your full potential and you will never rise to fill the position you should have filled. Thou shalt not excel. Then, if Reuben heard those five statements and his chest was beginning to expand and his head was rising, I can tell you, this took the breath out of him. Thou shalt not accept. But then the next bit was worse. Because. He said, Reuben, there's a leadership that you have lost. And he said, the reason you have lost this leadership is because there was a day in your life when you took license. And he said, you defiled your father's couch and you committed an act of immorality. But you say, Father, that's over 30 years ago. I'm not actually sure that any of the other boys knew anything about it. It's just mentioned in a verse that's tucked away in at the end of Genesis chapter 35, and there's very little comment and very little fuss about it. And you would say that time will be a healer, and time will cover it over, and it was a bad blunder. It was a bad blunder, but everybody forget it. Before old Jacob died, he said, I want to say there's something that's happened in your life, Reuben. And he said,
I'm sorry to tell you. But he said, I have to tell you in front of the 11. He said, that thing that has happened has crippled you for leadership forever. He said, you're in a position of privilege as my firstborn. And he said, you have liberties in my house that none of the others have. And he said, you made a breach of a position of trust. And you not only breach a position of fidelity, but you breach the position of purity. And he said, you crossed a boundary that you should never have crossed. And he said, because of that, thou shalt not excel. Now, where does that leave us? You tell me, without speaking out, you tell me how many lessons do spring out of that to us tonight? I'm not going to be expanding upon them all, and I'm not going to stretch them out. But one lesson, just let me mention one lesson that stands as clear as the noonday sun, is just this. That sin of the nature that we're reading about in this passage, sin like that is serious and it's not forgotten. Sometimes people commit sin. Sometimes it's covered as well as committed. Sometimes it's well covered. But remember, it will come out sooner or later. You see, this passage, and I know how the brethren use it, but I'm quite happy with it. The brethren often tell us that there are a number of chapters in the Bible that are nearly like foreshadowings of the judgment seat of Christ. You remember when David was almost gone too, he gave a list of his mighty men. And when you get to the end of the book of Samuel, you have the exploits of those various men and their distinctions and so on. You remember when the Apostle Paul gets to the end of the Epistle to the Romans, he mentions a list of names. And he says this and that and the other about some of those early Christians. And the brethren have told us that this chapter and those other chapters, just like the judgment seat of Christ. But you say, I thought of the judgment seat of Christ, I would never be judged for my sin. No, that's right. But sins are covered by the blood of Christ. That's a comfort. There's maybe someone here tonight has committed a sin in your life. You know, sometimes Christians, they don't have any concern now about the sins that were forgiven the night that they came and trusted Christ at the beginning. Their black past was completely blotted out. But what about serious sins that have happened since conversion day? Now what about that? Well, can I say that those sins since conversion's day are as fully covered by the blood of Christ as the ones before it. But you say, there's something that's happened, and I can't forgive myself. People come to me sometimes, and they say that. Something has happened, and it's on my mind. I feel bad about it. I have confessed it to the Lord, but I can't forgive myself, and I'm here, and I can't get my head lifted, and I'm ground down, and it's always on my mind, and I just can't get away with it. I can't forgive myself. Where did you ever come across that talk? By forgiving yourself. Did you ever find that in the Bible? And if you did manage to forgive yourself, what good would it do if God didn't forgive you? And if you could find out for assurance that God has forgiven me, and it's clear between my soul and God, despite the seriousness of what I have done, if God has forgiven me, it really doesn't matter whether I forgive myself or not, so long as God has forgiven me. Now, don't become unduly concerned about forgiving yourself. It's God forgiving. And if I can have the sin confessed and cleared, I'm not talking now if it matters the need of discipline and so on. That's another category. But even that takes place. If I can have things forgiven and clear, thank God the sky of communion can be absolutely blue. Or do you say that I just move on from there as if nothing happened? Not quite. Not quite. You see, in this pronouncement upon Reuben, I can see God's grace, and at the same time I can see God's government. And wherever members of God's family sin, those two things will be in operation. You say you need to explain a little bit more what you mean by that. Well, if this had been under law, I know the law wasn't given at this time, but Jacob's speaking about the time when the children of Israel will be in the promised land, and the descendants of Reuben will be in the promised land, and in their inheritance and so on, and the law will be given by that time. If this was to be judged by law, Reuben would be dead. Now Jacob didn't say, Reuben, you defiled your father's couch, you committed a serious act of immorality, and because of that serious act of immorality, your descendants will never ever get into the land, and thou shalt not exist. Thou shalt not exist. You'll be blotted out. He said, thou shalt not excel. Now he said, God's grace will allow you and your seed to continue. But he says, God's government will mean that you will never have the position of leadership that you otherwise could have had. Now, I know that I've allowed myself to go into a whole realm there that nearly every statement that I've made there just in the past few minutes, they nearly all need to be qualified and qualified again. And I hope that you'll understand that I'm not talking about every single individual case with all the different contours and all the different extenuating circumstances. I'm making general statements. Serious sin can be committed. By the grace of God, serious sin can be forgiven when it's honestly confessed, covered by the blood of Christ. But remember, even though it's forgiven in His grace, if a person commits serious sin in his life, it can have a crippling effect upon him. And it can. I'm not saying always does, or always should. And I'm not saying this about every sin, but there are sins that can mean a man can be in fellowship. He can be in the land. He can be amongst the people of God. But he cannot assume positions of leadership. Thou shalt not excel because. Then, sin is serious. Sin can be forgiven. Of course, just a bit at the cost of maybe over-repeating myself, can I speak? I trust, at least in measure, conscious of my own weakness. Because men who were a lot stronger than I am or ever will be, they went down in this very area of moral purity. But I trust conscious of my own weakness and silently crying to God as I speak to you, silently crying to Him for preservation. Can I say to younger brethren here tonight, younger sisters, younger brethren especially, just in this context, you be very careful that there's no moral impropriety in your early life that down the line will leave things extremely difficult and will leave you under a permanent handicap. Now, we believe in restoration and forgiveness, but sin is serious, and especially in a world, I'm making this against the background of a society where these things are poo-pooed and casual relationships and breaches of morality, they are discounted as, well, it doesn't really matter. Everybody does it. It's the way it's done. It's published and splashed in the newspapers, and everybody eventually accepts it because it's so popular. That may be the way of society. But remember, the Bible still looks upon these matters very, very. Now, there's another little side here. I've left a little statement out. Because Jacob not only speaks about Reuben's status, and Reuben's sin, and Reuben's sentence, but he uses a simile for Reuben. You went up to my couch, defiled it, took advantage of a situation of trust. He said, there's a basic problem that you're unstable as water. You see, now I'm coming into a slightly different area, but it's closely linked with the one that I have just mentioned. Jacob says, Reuben, the problem's this. You say to me, but Father, it was just a slip. It was just a one-off. It was a very serious slip, because I don't want to go into the expressions that Jacob uses here, but he repeats it three times to show that it was a very serious breach of trust and an exploitation of privilege. But he says, no, Reuben, he says, it wasn't just a slip. He says, that thing that you did, he says, it was a manifestation of a very serious weakness in your character. He says, it was one act. All right, Reuben, a very serious act. And he said, I felt it keenly. But he said, it manifested to me that there was an instability in you. Now, this is an interesting expression. Indeed, it has caused Bible scholars and translators a little bit of a problem, because sometimes they have just wondered, what's the figure behind this unstable as water? Some think that it's just like if I took the glass of water and if I tilted that glass, the water would just run out all over. And if you go into a pond of water and you splash about, water can be easily shaken. It's not stable. It's not fixed. It's not firm. It's not solid. Unstable as water. Maybe. There's another view that I would maybe incline to, that this word unstable is a difficult Hebrew word, but it may come from a background that refers to water that has been boiled. It's not just ordinary water, cold water, that can be shaken and moved easily. But you know as well as I do, you put on your kettle and the water boils. You put the heat to it, and the elements, or put it on the gas ring or whatever, and the heat rises, and then the water gets warm, and then it gets hot, and then eventually what happens? When there's so much flame, the water reaches a particular temperature and it starts to bubble. And keep the heat at it, and it will bubble and bubble, and it'll bubble even more, and it can bubble right out over. I think that's perhaps the idea. He says, Reuben, there's a thing in your character, and he says, you're just as liable to spill over as boiling water. So he said, that was the problem. He said, there was a day in your life, and he said, the flame became too hot. And he said, you never learned. You never learned what it was to control those bubbling passions that are within your heart. And he said, instead of controlling them, he said, you inflamed them. And it took you into the difficulty that I have just mentioned. Now, let me say this. Again, I'm speaking to brethren just now. Younger brethren, us all. In the heart of every man, there's passion, or lust, or whatever you want to call it. There is lust. And if it's inflamed, it can boil over. Now that's true of every man. I speak as a man, simple man, to men, and to all of you here today. You know exactly what I'm saying without any elaboration. However, having said that about every man, there are some men
and some people, they could come to boiling points more quickly than others, and are susceptible to temptations in that moral realm. We are all susceptible. Some are very especially susceptible. Now, what I want to say to you is this. You know, if you've your weakness, we're all weak, but some may have a special weakness in that area, and they could boil up very quickly. What I just want to say to you is this. You watch. You watch the flame. Now, you know that if you read certain books, if you slip in and buy certain newspapers, speaking to the younger generation, you know if you visit certain websites that you're just putting the water on the boil. And once the water gets onto the boil, it's hard to control. It doesn't stop immediately. Unstable as boiling water, thou shalt not excel. So the man who was excellent lost his excellency because there was a character weakness that he didn't judge. It led him into one specific sin that greatly left him embarrassed at his father's dying death. The carnality of Reuben that meant the loss of leadership. Now, I've said too much about that, and yet I hope it will help us to watch, because we're living in a dangerous world, and may the Lord preserve us all. May we be conscious of the dangers that these things cannot be tempered or fed. The next two are brought together, Simeon and Levi, from verse number 5 down to verse number 7. Of course, that second section, it commences with a very strange expression. Simeon and Levi are brethren. You say, you wouldn't need an A star to know that. Sure, these boys were all brothers. They were 12 brothers in the one family. This is the only occasion in the chapter where Jacob has two of them together in the one statement. The other 10, he sticks with them as one by one. But with these two, he brings them together. And what he means is this, that they were two of a kind. Now, they got into cahoots. And between the two of them, by a conspiracy, do you see what it says in verse number 6? Their secret. Their secret. These two boys, they clubbed together. They hatched a conspiracy. What about their crime? Well, he says in verse number 6, they slew a man. And they dig down a wall. I said when I was reading that many times say that they crippled the oxen. It's a very sordid story. I would hardly read it in public. But you know that, just to tell you it in very sketchy detail here, that there was a certain group of people and they interfered with Jacob's only daughter, a girl called Dinah. And these two boys took it very ill. And they say, we'd get our own back. We'd get our own back. Now, one of them wasn't enough to do it. They needed two. To do what they intended to do, they needed two. So Simeon and Levi clubbed together. They hatched a conspiracy. And with the instruments of cruelty, they went to the family that had interfered with their sister, and they hacked them to pieces. And when it was over, Jacob said, look, boys, I want to tell you what you've done. He said, do you see in this whole area? He said, the way that you men lost your temper and wreaked vengeance on those neighbors, he said, you've made my name to stink. And he said, I'm going to have to move house. They were cruel. They were vindictive. Now, what was the real problem here? It wasn't passion. That was Reuben's problem. It was passion in the sense of lustful passion. You see what's identified in verse number 7? He says, cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath said, these boys, he said, I want to tell you two boys. He said, you're going to have to pay a price. Now, that, I'm not going into that. Forgive me if you want to, but ask me. He said, cursed be their anger. Now, here again, I see grace. He doesn't say, cursed be the boys. He didn't curse the boys. But he says, cursed be their anger, for it was fierce. Cursed be their wrath, for it was cruel. He cursed the sin, but not the man who committed it. And he said, I'll divide you in Jacob, I'll scatter you in Israel. The two boys that had clubbed together in this conspiracy. He said, I tell you what, you two boys are the better kept apart. But he said, you're a bad company. And he says, you'll be divided in Jacob and you'll be scattered in Israel. And he said, this clubbiness that's married to a very, very bad temper. He said, that's better. Can I just issue a very serious little warning, and yet I'll be brief about it. Dear brethren, watch your company. If somebody wants you to club with them in a conspiracy, you be very careful. Watch your company. I never like people that go about behind scenes trying to get upset started. You know, secret agreements and secret meetings and clubs and conspiracies and private things. I know people have to discuss things and brethren and responsibility. I'm not speaking about that at all. I'm talking about subversive secrecy. Watch your company. And the second lesson is this. Watch your temper. You know, sometimes... Now, I know, oh, you say it's already talking, but this crowd of Shechemites, they had destroyed these boys' sisters. It was a family hurt. I know. Very serious. Very sad. But... when the Shechemites committed a sin against Dinah, these men committed a greater sin against the Shechemites. And the Shechemites committed the sin of fornication. But to try and get vengeance on that, these men committed the sin of murder. And it's an old hectic statement, but we need to remember, two wrongs don't make a right. Sometimes we can lose our temper over the wrongs that other people do, and they are wrong, and everybody knows they're wrong, and there's no one trying to justify it, and sin has to be dealt with, and dealt with righteously. Oh, dear brother, if we are judging sin, may the gracious Lord of heaven always touch our hearts and help us, that we will judge sin out of a sense of righteousness, but never out of a sense of revenge. Because revenge and bitterness and hardness and going over the top, as these men did, they slew a man, they crippled oxen. Jacob said, I cannot have any more confidence than these boys. If it was the carnality of Reuben, it was the cruelty of Simeon and Levi that really got there. Mind you, I tell you, this meeting wasn't going too well. This one's not going too well either, because I will soon need to be stopped, and I'll wind this up very, very quickly. But I know if I'd been fella number 10, I'd have been feeling a wee bit squeamish to this time. I'd say, you wouldn't mind if I leave the room. I'd have been looking to get out. It was getting worse. Thank God when he got to Judah, the whole atmosphere changed. We'll be on it tomorrow night. In verse number 8, he says, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. But he was a rascal. He was a right rascal. And how was it that Jacob condemned Reuben for a sin of immorality? Judah committed a sin of immorality, and Jacob said to Judah, you'll be praised. You have to come back tomorrow night to get the answer to that, because that's a crux. So we're going to leave Judah, and I want to just, as I close the meeting, I'm going to pull together three. In verse number 13, down to verse number 18, we have Zebulun, Issachar, and Dan.
Now, as far as Zebulun was concerned, he had a very doubtful border. He says, his border shall be towards Zidon. A blue light flashing there. His border shall be towards Zidon. I say a blue light or a red light or an orange light, whatever you use, it's flashing there. Zidon. Doesn't sound a great place to have your border leading on towards Zidon, but however, Isaac is a man with a doubtful border. Look at, Zebulun, I beg your pardon. Zebulun has a doubtful border, verse 6. Isaac, he's a strong ass crouching down between two burdens. Verse 14, he saw that rest was good, the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear, he became servant on the tribute. Isaac is a man with a double burden. Zebulun has a doubtful border. Isaac has a double burden. He's a strong ass crouching down between two burdens. What about Dan? Look at verse 16. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Man, you say he's a good one. Verse 17. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heels so that the rider falleth backward. If it was Zebulun's border that was doubtful, and if it was Isaac's burden that were double, it was John's bite that was deadly. He had a bad bite. If he nipped in behind you, I tell you, if he nipped in behind you, you had it. There are boys like that still. Like, you know, when I was going about as a lad on the bread van to some of the brothers in Lurgan, there's some of those little dogs like Jack Russell Terriers and so on, and you always dreaded them nipping in behind. You know, it wasn't so bad if you had a big dog coming and hunching at you just face to face, but it's the wee fella nipping in behind, and just when you were trying, what you weren't thinking, he just caught you. There are boys, there are human Jack Russells too, believe it or not. It's hard to get a leash just to hold them, but they do exist. What about the border? Can I say just as we have to stop? Watch that your border doesn't head towards Zidon. You know, later on in history, Zidon was the place that Jezebel came from. Every life has to have boundaries, and every life has to have borders. Some people try to live their Christian life in the land of Canaan and in the land of Christianity, and they have their border as close to the world as they can go without actually being in it. Dear young man, can I say to you, if you put your border towards Zidon, it'll not surprise me if you get a bride from Zidon, and if you're as good as Jezebel, she'll give you enough to think of it. She'll be able to share your pension, I can tell you. Watch your border. Keep your distance from the world. Establish your coast closer to Canaan. Jacob said, as I think about Zebulun, the difficulty with Zebulun is just this, that they'll be facing the wrong direction and they'll be bordering with a very, very dangerous, doubtful world. I never think it's a good thing. And we're not becoming isolationists now. And we're not preaching Christians should live just in a kind of a prison or anything like that. But I never think it's a good thing. There are some people, and it seems to me, that they make up their minds, I'm a Christian, but I'm going to be as like a person of the world in my dress, in my lifestyle, in my hobbies and pleasures and leisure life and so on. I'm going to be as like a person of the world as I can be. And I'm going to shave as close as possible and yet stay in the assembly. Now, we've seen quite a bit of that. And the trouble is this. Most of the people that I have noticed that go too close to the border, it might take a while, but they end up on the wrong side of it. They end up on the Zidon side of it. A doubtful border for Zebulun. And you know as well as I do that there was hardly ever any great princes rose from Zebulun. They never made any mark on the history of God's people. You know why?
Just because of this border that I've mentioned.
Now, secondly,
give me just 2 minutes here.
What about Issachar? Issachar is a straw hat.
I don't know that Jacob was just the best man for giving compliments.
You mightn't have, he didn't boost your ego. A strong ass. If you told some of these people, if you were called an ass, in our day, it wouldn't send you home thinking you were improving. But this was a compliment. Mr. Darby translates this as an ass of bone. That is, here was an animal that was strong and bony. And I tell you, it could do some work. You see, there'd be asses that would have a fragile frame, and they wouldn't be much good for their labor. But here's a pride, and they're just like a strong, bony ass. They could do some work. But you know, instead of working, it says that Issachar saw that rest was good. So he just laid out. And he just... And he had a burden on this side, and he had a burden on that side, and he could have carried two more burdens, because he was strong and done it. But instead of labor, he preferred leisure. And because he preferred leisure to labor, and just lay down, Issachar never achieved his true potential. No, dear brother, let me say this, as I heartily so. I believe, if every Christian in every assembly in the north of Ireland, I want you to listen to this. If every Christian in every assembly in north of Ireland was doing what he or she could do. Now, I'm not asking anybody to do what they can do. If you can't preach, we'll never ask you to do it. Don't worry. But if everybody was doing what he or she could do, I believe assembly testimony was a revolutionary. We have an awful lot of people, and they could do it. They're strong, they're gifted, they're capable. But they just lay down. They just collapse. And they don't bother. If you have meetings, they'll go on holiday. If you have special meetings for a week or two, they'll take a couple of nights off. If you have something extra to be done, they'll always have alternative engagement. And here's a tribe, they have a capacity, but it's crippled by a love of comfort and rest and idleness. They love tillage and they love tribute. I'll not go into that. Those are the two burdens that weigh them down. Tillage on the one hand and tribute on the other. Many people are crippled in their assembly life because they're too fond of the soil and too fond of the silver. But I better not. That'll take me another half hour or something. Finally, if Zebulun has the doubtful border, Issachar has the double burden, brought into captivity. Zebulun has conformity to the world, Issachar has captivity. Dan has the doubtful bite. Nipton, you know, Dan was the first tribe in Israel that started institutionalized idolatry. And he started another center where the people of God were supposed to go. He divided the interests. He did well for a time, and then he turned turtle, and just like a serpent, blending and bending and biting, he turned out very crude. What did you say, boys? That's a fair picture. It's time you did stop. I am stopping. Is it any wonder when all that was over, you know what Jacob said? You know what he said? When he thought about the carnality of Reuben and the cruelty of Simeon and Levi and the conformity of Zebulun and the captivity of Issachar and the craft of Dan, you know what Jacob says? He says, Lord, he says, I have waited for thy salvation. He says, we need a change, and God can give a change. And if you come back to one of these, you'll find that in the space of 24 hours, things have mightily changed. And we'll go to the positive side. Tonight have been the negative, tomorrow the positive. What we can have through the grace of God and the salvation of God and the power of Christ. May the Lord help us and bless his word, shall we pray.